Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August the 24th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, we're going to be listening to Kathleen and David Hurtie. Their subject, Sharing Vitality, the ecumenical scene today. Let's join in their discussion now in progress.
Well, that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of my ecumenical background. I might say that the Augustana Lutheran Church has had an interesting history itself ecumenically. It was a church, of course, founded by Swedes who had a strong commitment to the Lutheran confessions. The very name, Augustana, is taken from the Latin term Confessio Augustana, the very heart of Lutheran confessions. But at the same time, it was deeply influenced by Nathan Soderblom, who was one of the big leaders in the ecumenical movement of the 1920s and 30s, through one of the outstanding theologians of our Augustana Church, Conrad Bergendorf. And he brought a dimension to the Augustana tradition that was both faithful to the Lutheran confessions, but at the same time very much open to the ecumenical mood of the day and world in which we were living. So I think we have, you know, as Lutherans, a responsibility to be ecumenical in our outlook at the same time as being faithful to our own tradition as Lutherans.
Okay. We've had a chance to tell a little bit about our ecumenical journey. I'd like to hear something of your ecumenical experience. Are there ecumenical instances in your life where you have had a rich experience, or have you experienced Christian unity in some way? Yeah.
Two things come to mind. One, my birthplace, which was New Sweden Lutheran Church in Southeast Iowa, which is this fall celebrating its 150th anniversary. And we had a community, of course, of Swedes around that church, but there was an equally strong community of Germans that had their church a mile from ours. And then up the road a little ways, we had a Methodist church that was very strong. And so our neighbors were people who were very faithful church people, but many of them, of course, went to their own churches, and we had that experience. Mm-hmm. Where we really got together, as I remembered as a child, was the school.
Yes,
we
right.
had a school, you see, which brought all of the kids
right.
together. Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, brought the parents together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we learned to know those people very well, but we almost never went to their church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of an unwritten thing. Well, you know, we have our own church, and you have yours, and so that's the way it was. But there were strong congregations made up of these different groups.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think what you pointed out is probably the experience of many of us who have spent time either as growing up in schools or professionally working in schools, having been a school teacher. I know that a lot of the conversations, if you talk about your faith at all, become a chance for you to struggle with and grapple with what faith means in an ecumenical setting or in a larger religious setting. By all means, can be a very effective thing. You have to know more what you believe in that kind of a context often than others. Other comments, other striking ecumenical experiences that you remember in your life?
It was my need to become ecumenical that brought me to a firmer relationship with Christ. I was brought in a Catholic home where I came home one day from sixth grade where I said, Mom, the priest said that the Lutherans going to go to heaven.
Weren't?
And weren't? They were.
Oh, were, they were.
Oh. And then my dad said, what kind of stuff are they teaching you in school now? What background I come from. And I was sure my girlfriend Sharon wasn't going to heaven. I knew what? She was going to purgatory. And wouldn't be limbo. But then I only dated Catholic men until I met my husband. And he is Lutheran, and we would spend long hours walking, talking about God. And one particular night he said, Carol, let's quit talking about God and talk to God. And that started our foundation in prayer for our marriage, and that happened like we were dating for just weeks. And then I went ahead before I got married and became a buyer in one of the stores, which was my goal, and then moved into his community, going to Mass every morning. And I said, God, whatever you want me to do, I will do. My life is yours. And then I became a tent maker, a youth director in a Lutheran church. And I've been in a Lutheran church since then, and have been involved in Women's Glow International for many years. And that's an ecumenical movement. And I knew that was an okay place because they had nuns there. and that is a very much, it's not just fundamental people. There's Methodists and Presbyterians and Lutherans and Catholics, and uh-huh. We've got people at that end there. And that's a real wonderful, embracing mm-hmm. place where they right. speak forth Jesus Christ mm-hmm. and all the rest falls to the side. Mm-hmm.
The word embrace is an interesting one, an embracing place, a place ecumenically where we can feel at home with others. I was just reading this morning in the Ecumenical Review, which is a journal put out by the World Council of Churches. It's an excellent journal, has a lot of interesting articles in it. But I happened to read an article about the theology of embrace. And the idea of understanding our theological perspective in a sense of both distance and belonging, which is interesting. This particular writer on that article is from Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, and is himself teaches at Fuller, but also is a Croatian by background. And he was trying to teaches also in Croatia. Was trying to struggle with this idea of ethnic struggle in its religious context often. And so he was speaking for a theology of embrace, where people can feel both it's unique and at the same time belonging to others. It's a wonderful term and a wonderful story.
It's interesting too about your story is that it's a kind of across all church. It's probably started by, I don't know how this group started, I'd heard of it, but it wasn't started by any denomination, was it?
No, a couple of women in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People for whom faith and faithfulness are wedded together, how one lives and what one believes can be talked about together in a welcoming way. Well, the question in the background for us this morning is indeed, how do we experience Christian unity, and how do we live into both the gift of unity that God gives us through Jesus Christ and the task to embody that unity more fully and to do it in a way that is joyful and loving and embracing. So those questions will continue. I thought if you would be interested to look just a little bit at the history of ecumenism in this century. There's a magazine, some of you may read it, called The Christian Century. It'll be interesting to think what they may do in terms of changing their name after. But in this magazine is published out of the University of Chicago. And is a very interesting, if you want to keep up on what's going on along ecumenically, it's a good thing to use. But thinking of this century as a sort of a historical flow of ecumenism, that's not the whole history of ecumenism by any means. It started, ecumenism has been...
Started with Jesus.
Part?
With Jesus.
Right.
It was stated it started probably with Abraham.
Essence of the church. But we'll take this little slice, this century, and look at what people have been doing this year. If we were to take a kind of a timeline, a significant date is 1910, when the first World Missionary Conference was held. I'm sorry to say that I don't remember the city. Most ecumenical conferences
Edinburgh.
Are named by the cities.
Edinburgh, I think.
Oh, it was Edinburgh.
I think
right.
so.
Right, I think you're right. This is what team teaching offers. A collective memory.
I think that was
right. Okay. World Missionary Conference. And that whole stream of churches coming together to talk about sharing Christ in the whole world, bringing the vision of Christ that way. In 1925, in Stockholm, Dave mentioned earlier the work of Bishop Nathan Soderblom. This was shortly after the First World War, and there was need for the churches to come together and talk about their life of faith in terms of a global context. And Bishop Nathan Soderblom, who was a Lutheran, happened to be a key leader in that movement. Not alone, it wasn't just Lutherans, it was a global gathering of churches who gathered in 1925 in a conference called Life and Work. The idea that the churches needed to put their faith to practice in a world that was torn in major ways, broken by war. In 1927, in Lausanne, Switzerland, another major conference was held, and that was called the Faith and Order Conference. So those three streams of work, mission, life and work, and faith and order. The faith and order were more the theological discussions related to what we're doing and why we do it. What life and work were more action-oriented. Those streams of the ecumenical movement came together after the Second World War in 1948 in Amsterdam. In the formation of the World Council of Churches. So the WCC was formed in 1948, a few years after the Second World War had ended, when there was the desire on the part of people to bring these streams of work. Work had followed from each of these conferences on three separate tracks, and the idea was to bring those together in one track through the World Council of Churches. The Lutherans have been, many of the Lutherans, not all Lutheran churches, but many of the Lutheran churches have been a part of the World Council of Churches since its beginning.
The World Student Christian Federation also was kind of an element that was actively involved in ecumenical formation.
WSCF started actually long before. In fact, it originated before these other major conferences, and it was some of the movements of the students as they grew older that formulated these other pieces.
Yeah, they became the leaders.
So they became the leaders in the World Council work. The Lutheran Church in America, the Lutheran Church in America was I'm not sure which Lutheran churches were members of the formation.
Well, the Augustana Lutheran Church was a member. That's back before the mergers LCA and ALC.
And many of the world churches within the Lutheran World Federation also were a part of that. This is a quick sketch, not very thorough, but at least it gives you an idea. It was at the time in the United States in 1950, that the National Council of Churches was born, but it too had predecessors. In the 1890s, and in some cases even before that, the Sunday school movement in the United States had started, where Sunday school teachers came together and created curriculum across denominational lines. So the Sunday school movement was very important in the United States. And the Sunday school movement was predominantly a lay-led movement where teachers who had responsibility for Christian education came together in and worked on curriculum together. It's 1870s, I think, earlier, 1890s. The first state councils of churches were formed. The first one was in Maine. Number of other councils in the Northeast formed, and New York formed a council, and they pushed the national level denominations to organize a council of churches in the United States. There was an old federal council of churches, which then became the predecessor of the national council. Many local councils were also forming in these years. I just had a letter when I first came to work at the National Council from a little town in Methuen, Massachusetts, who said, "We are the oldest council in the country," continuously in progress. So these are the various streams that have come together. It was in most of the churches in the National Council of Churches were mainline Protestant, and Lutherans were in also at the beginning of the National Council. These were Protestant churches from all over the world. About 300 churches, 360 something, belonged to the National Council, national level churches, and about 33 denominations in the U.S., Lutheran, Episcopalian, and the mainline Protestants, and Orthodox churches. 9 different Orthodox churches belong here. Roman Catholics have not been members of either of these councils and still are not. But the interesting thing in 1964 and a watershed was in the early 60s, but it's actually 61, I think, to 64, mm-hmm. Vatican II, the council called by Pope John Paul the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd, was very influential in organizing a new vision of ecumenism out of the history and tradition of the Roman Catholic Church, a very significant event. And following this time, in the late 60s, many Roman Catholic dioceses and parishes became members of state and local councils of churches. So it is at the state and local level where Roman Catholics also participate. Roman Catholics work with, in conjunction with, and collaborate with, or coordinate some of their work with national and world and national councils, but they're actual members of state and local councils of churches. Also, some of you may be in communities where you've heard about the COCU churches, or churches Council on Christian Unity, covenanting churches together in Christian unity. Those are, there are 12, is it 9 or 12 denominations that are COCU? I think it's 9. 3 African-American churches, the Presbyterians, the UCC, the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, the Methodists,
and the Episcopalians,
and Christian Methodist Episcopal, African Methodist Episcopal, and one of the other African Methodist Episcopal Zion. Those churches form what's called COCU, and they're working on a covenant. Hopefully by the year 2000, there will be much more unanimity in those churches as well. So there's been a lot of happening in this century, and there's doesn't even begin to talk about the little community ministries that have formed and popped up in many communities all over the country, of churches seeing a need in a community and trying to work together to meet that need.
Maybe some of you have examples of local ecumenical efforts across your parish lines. Do you have things going on in your communities that are in effect ecumenical efforts?
In our area, we have a Bible study fellowship, which is non-denominational.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. It attracts a huge gathering. And right. Actually, it's also men meet in another group.
Uh-huh. But what community is that?
Federal Way.
Federal Way, I see, uh-huh.
And also, the local church is something we gather together for combination musical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, musical, ecumenical music events.
One of the common ecumenical endeavors in many cities today are around feeding the hungry.
Any of you have organizations that you work with in that? In
Federal Way.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Does it have a name?
It's the caregivers.
Uh-huh. Caregivers. So it's part of the community ministries that are developing around those specified certain needs. As a community of caregivers, do you ever meet to worship together or do any other celebration together?
I don't think community caregivers has, and I'm aware of. Do you have some? But we had at Christmas, we went to
Right, and
that would be the musical. Musical events, yeah. So a lot of the community ministries are trying to organize events, worship or music events that bring the people together so they learn about each other in a worship context as well as in an active context.
There was a column in the Tacoma paper by a Roman Catholic laywoman who was heavily involved in soup kitchen mm-hmm. ministry and calling attention to the mm-hmm. ecumenical participation mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. ministry. And she mm-hmm. says we can serve soup together, but we can't take
communion together.
Right. Which is probably more important than
Well, that's a really good illustration of some of the tensions today in ecumenical life, because there is a desire on the part of many to make community more whole, to serve soup, to feed people and to help people. But there's also that yearning for a common table of the Eucharist. And so, you know, and people are working on that from all different angles in a lot of ways. But in Tacoma, there's some other interesting things going on. The Tacoma Associated Ministries and the College of Puget Sound and Pacific Lutheran University have a thing called Communiversity. That is a very creative way of bringing people together to study. It's kind of like an open classroom on, what is it, four Sundays in February or something like that, where people volunteer to teach and volunteer to take classes and learn together in a whole wide range of topics. So, yeah.
In your timeline, where do you put the NCCJ?
Oh, the National Conference on Christians and Jews. That's a good question. I don't have the date in which they organized in the United States. The International Conference on Christians and Jews, I think, has been going for at least half of the century. Do you know that?
No,
you don't know the date.
I didn't know they were international.
Yes, there's an international conference of Christians and Jews, and now the National Conference of Christians and Jews has taken a new name, and it's just being called National Conference. And the reason they chose to do that, and that's just happened within this last year, is because their purpose is to help bring about understanding in its original purpose between Christians and Jews. Now they're going to include learning more and developing understanding between Christians, Jews, Muslims, and others.
There's also the International Consultation on English Texts that uh-huh. come together to agree on the newer formulations yeah. of the creeds and the Lord's Prayer.
Right, and have you been serving on that consultation?
No.
Let's see, International Consultation on
English
Texts.
Yeah.
The one of the outcomes of that is the wording for the Lord's Prayer, which we use here, I think, at Holton, which is really a very beautiful representation. Many of our, it's in the ELCA hymnal, you have two choices, and it's the one that's less familiar.
Same in the Book of Common Prayer.
Right, for the Episcopalian Church and all. And it's becoming a common text then for liturgy and understanding, which is very, very nice.
We're in Missouri.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really on the leading edge of ecumenism. We're kind of consider ourselves liberal
land
of the Wisconsin Senate.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
But they do raise a point, and I don't know where that would fit into your conversation, that in, to really capsulize their point of view, if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do you fit that into ecumenism?
And well, I think that's a very, go ahead, you might want to speak to that, because well, I think that's a key mm-hmm. question, it really is.
The Lutheran Church in America and the ELCA, I guess, have had a principle, or a couple of principles, for the guidance as far as our ecumenical stance is concerned. It's called the Evangelical Principle and the Representative Principle. Meaning that, first of all, it's not that we don't relate to other organizations and churches, but, I mean, the evangelical principle means that you uphold the central mission or position of the gospel. That should be central, that Jesus Christ is, you know, Lord and Savior, so to speak. And I can remember back in the days of Franklin Clark Fry, he was very strong on developing that particular principle when it came to, you know, the documents that were formulated around the Council of Churches. That was a central issue. That's a fundamental issue. Now, I realize that there's a lot more to our Lutheran confessions than that, but to uphold the evangelical principle that central to our mission as Christians is to uphold, you know, the gospel as it is expressed in Jesus Christ. The representative principle means that when you have a council of churches, or a churchly organization, that you participate on the basis of churches that are truly representing churches. In other words, are people that are really representing churches. You know, you don't have the YMCA, say, becoming a member of a council of churches. They aren't really a church. So you want to be sure that you're, when you're talking about a council of churches, that you're faithfully having representatives come from churches that, you know, are truly churches that represent their mission as being an evangelical mission. I think that's one of the issues that at stake here. I know the Missouri Synod has had, you know, a different stance than the Lutheran Church in America, or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or the American Lutheran Church at that point.
Here's where the
maybe
work
he wants
of
to respond.
Conrad Bergendorf is also helpful.
Yeah, what, but you were going to say something?
Conrad Bergendorf's position was that you can have both confessional integrity and ecumenical hospitality, that those two are not mutually exclusive, so that you bring into the ecumenical conversation about Christian unity the perspective that you have as a particular faith community, but you also listen in respectful dialogue to the other. And the listening and learning from others within the Christian community centered around a conversation about the gospel can be a very healthy and also heated discussion, because people bring different perspectives on that. So for those churches that are ecumenical, the value is in the process of deep, profound conversations around work that we, where the commonalities are and where the distinctions are. For a long time, that stress was on the distinctions, the differences. Now I think there's beginning to be a real commitment to the commonalities, those things that we share. Not watered down pablum type, but what are the real essences of, what is the essence of living out the prayer of Jesus Christ for unity, or what is the essence of the gospel that we share? I sent for, and we don't even begin to have time to talk about it, the history of the dialogues that are going on, because there's a whole other stream of ecumenism that is involved in major dialogues between churches. The ELCA, for example, is in major dialogue with the Anglicans worldwide now. So in the U.S., it's Lutheran Episcopal dialogue. And the Lutherans are also in dialogue with the Roman Catholics around particular subjects, and in dialogue with the Reformed tradition, four different Reformed churches in a common dialogue with Lutherans. And decisions will be made in 1997. If you'd like to pick up one of these, you can. These are the decisions that will be made by the ELCA as to approving the essence of the dialogues that have been ongoing for a number of years. And that's the dialogues take place among respected theologians chosen by each church, but they publish documents that are available for discussion and reception and response by people in the churches. And the idea is to have a very good conversation and to know more fully then what we hold particularly precious and where we can find room to share. And that. So this is these books capsule the history of the dialogues worldwide. This particular piece shows, for those of you who are interested in the ELCA, the particular current dialogues that are ongoing there.
I might also comment that this book is very helpful to help clarify what the ecumenical stance of the ELCA is. It's a position that was adopted by the ELCA in 1991, and it really lays out how we, as Lutherans of our particular stripe, approach ecumenical relationships. And it's interesting here in the very one of the paragraphs I'd like to just share with you. It even delves into the matter of dealing with people of other faith than of Christian faith. I'll just read this quick paragraph here. It's like ecumenism has as its focus and goal clarity of understanding among Christians and a greater realization of unity among Christ's people. And here's where I go back now to John 17. Jesus assumed that there was unity among Christians. It's a gift. It's not something we create. We do not make unity. I mean, it's a given. We have broken the unity by our human frailties, by our self-centeredness, by our short-sightedness, by our human intellect that maybe wants to have certain things done our way. I think there's a kind of a givenness about the unity that Christ is praying for in that prayer, what we sometimes refer to as a high priestly prayer. So unity is a something that we ought to work for, because that's what Jesus, what God intends. Our separateness is sin. I mean, really, I have to be very frank about it. I think the separateness that we experience as Christians is contrary to the will of God. So it's our responsibility to work for Christian understanding and unity. That's one of at the heart of ecumenical endeavor. But going on, it says, as it is closely related to the mission of the gospel to all the world, it should not be confused with the importance but distinct responsibility for the church to enter into conversations and reach greater understanding with people of all other faiths. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America does engage in a variety of ways in this interfaith work and needs in the future a separate official statement to describe its commitments and aspirations in this area. of working with people of other faith. When that statement is prepared, special attention must be given to the distinctiveness of Judaism. I mean, we need also to, you know, begin to clean up our act, so to speak, in relationship to the Jewish community. But beyond that, now we're experiencing a growing Muslim community in the United States. So we are challenged to do even business with that. So I think that our ecumenical endeavor, you know, to deal with Christians and other people of other faith and people of no faith is a real responsibility. It's part of our mission. And Jesus' prayer, you see, for that the world might believe, I mean, to be working as a Christian, unified Christian community is really the goal, it seems to me, of being faithful to the gospel, of proclaiming the mission of Jesus to the world. So that's why I think we really have to take ecumenical work as at the very heart of the mission of the church. So I mean, you know, that's kind of my sermon for the morning. Amen.
We have just a few minutes left, and I do want to certainly encourage more questions as well. But I did want to take a little prerogative to share a couple of resources that I brought, which you can take with you. The office that I am director for publishes a newsletter called Core Letter, which is a newsletter that lifts up the stories of what's happening in local places. And there's some real exciting stories that happen in local places. You can't get it just from two issues, but I brought two. But one of the fun things in my work is telling the stories of people's activities around the country. And so I'll leave these around here where you can pick them up. And you're welcome to pick up the 1995 ELCA decisions. And as far as these go, you're welcome to pick those up as well. One of the main things that you may have come in contact and not realized was connected with the National Council of Churches is the new Revised Standard Version of the Bible. That copyright is owned by the NCC. The work of translation has been sponsored by the NCC for many years. So the first translation, the Revised Standard Version, was done many years ago with a team of theologians, and some Jewish scholars were included in the new Revised Standard Version for the Hebrew Scriptures. The translation is an ongoing work, and there will be others. They're already starting to work on it, taking account of all the new scholarship. I'm involved in a project right now called God's Word for All the People, trying to get more in language that is more sensitive to women. So I brought along some brochures that describe that particular perspective, and a lot of other things here. This is a brochure that describes the National Council of Churches itself, lists its members on the back, and some other things on interreligious understanding, and a piece from Basse, which is the World Council of Churches Study Center in Basse, Geneva, outside of Geneva, Switzerland. This is the 95 program, but if any of you ever want to go and have an ecumenical global experience, Basse is not quite like Holden Village. It's a little different, but it has learning potential of equivalence, and it's a very exciting place to go. So you're welcome to help yourself to any and all. Are there any other questions before we close? Any fears about ecumenical life that are groveling in your stomachs? Because there are those, there really are. Any joys or hopes that you have?
I guess we always have fears when we deal with people that we haven't known before. I can remember, you know, when as a child, I guess I was mystified by the Roman Catholic Church, and you know, you would never set foot inside of it. You know, it was like a place where you. Now I feel just as comfortable there and as at home to go to services there as I do in a Lutheran church. You know, it's I guess it's you grow together in your openness to people as you meet them and get acquainted with them and begin to understand maybe where they're coming from, even though you may not always agree. I think that's where our own integrity as human beings, we have to honor that. But at the same time, we have to respect people of differing viewpoints than what we have. It seems to me that's kind of the maturing process that we all have to go through in whatever field we endeavor in, whether it be religion or otherwise.
And it is a journey, and we invite you into that journey. And if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to share with us throughout the week, we'll be here until a week from Thursday. So thank you very much for coming.